From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. West Side Story, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and The Sand Pebbles were directed by the same man who edited Citizen Kane. We meet Robert Wise on today's Fresh Air and talk about his early films and his first new film in 10 years, Rooftops, about homeless teenagers in New York. Homeless children in Bombay are the subject of Meera Nair's Academy Award-nominated feature, Salaam Bombay. Today, Nair tells us about shooting on location in Bombay's red light district and training real homeless children to act in the film. And we have reviews of the new jazz album from bassist Buell Neidlinger and a new memoir by Carl Bernstein. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest Robert Wise has directed just about every kind of film, musicals like West Side Story and The Sound of Music, horror films including Curse of the Cat People and The Body Snatcher, the science fiction films The Day the Earth Stood Still and Star Trek The Motion Picture, the dramas The Sand Pebbles, Odds Against Tomorrow and I Want to Live, the westerns Blood on the Moon and Tribute to a Bad Man, and the boxing film Somebody Up There Likes Me and The Setup. His films have won 19 Academy Awards. Robert Wise first went to Hollywood during the Depression, after his parents ran out of money to continue funding his college education. After working in the film shipping room of RKO, he worked his way up to apprentice sound cutter, then film editor. 2 years later, Wise got an Academy Award nomination for editing Orson Welles' landmark film, Citizen Kane. Robert Wise has just directed his first movie in 10 years. It's called Rooftops, and it's about homeless teenagers living on the roofs of abandoned tenements in Manhattan. Robert Wise, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
This is your first film in 10 years. Had you been in retirement? And if so, why did you come out?
No, I hadn't been in retirement. I'd been playing around with some projects over those years. I spent almost a year working on a hoped-for film with a musical version of Zorba, but because of certain financial problems with the parent company, it fell apart. During that time, I had retired, but I was very busy working with the Directors Guild, chairman of their 50th anniversary committee. And then I was president of the Motion Picture Academy for 3 years, just finished that last year, so I was very busy with that. So I've been very busy, but not busy making films, until this script of Rooftops came along last summer and caught my eye.
What caught your eye about it? In a way, it seems like an unlikely subject, since it's about teenagers living in Manhattan, and you've been living in Los Angeles for a long time, and you're also in your 70s, and I think frequently it's younger directors who are asked to direct the films about teenagers.
Well, I think that was one of the challenges I had. I felt it was time maybe to show that somebody of my generation can deal with young people and young actors and the problems of the young just as well as some of the young ones. And I liked the idea of the story. It dealt with something that was important to me. It mattered to the problem of the homelessness in New York. I liked the New York scene. Of course, I shot in New York quite often over the years in different films. Witnessed the whole opening reels of West Side Story.
Oh, yeah.
And there was some similarity there, you know, between West Side and Rooftops. Although Rooftops is not a musical like West Side Story, it does have music and dance in it. And dealing with the young people, it was very something that was very sympathetic to me. And it was those combinations of elements that decided me to say, hey, it's time I got another one going, and I like this.
How did you get the feeling of what street culture in New York is like now?
Well, I'd heard about it and read about it, but I wasn't quite as up-to-date on the knowledge until I got down into the Lower East Side. We shot the whole film back there in New York on the Lower East Side in what's called Alphabet City. That's down Avenues A, B, C, and D, and 3rd to 10th Street, something like that. And that is full of very, very mixed population and very loose population. Some very nice people, lovely people, but also a lot of drug dealing going on down there. And we shot in a lot of empty tenements, abandoned tenements, in some buildings they have squatters living there. In other buildings they have people called homesteaders. Those are people who are in there legitimately and allowed to have rent-free in the apartments there that as long as they fix up the buildings. So we had to deal with all these elements down that part of the city. And it was most interesting to see and fascinating to come in contact with.
Part of the plot of the movie is that a teenager living on the roof is getting thrown out by some drug dealers who want to move in and use that abandoned house as a shooting gallery. And I was wondering if anything similar happened to you while you were shooting, if there was a competition between right. you and drug dealers for the same houses.
Well, there wasn't a competition that way. It was very interesting. We do have a drug bust in the film, and while we were shooting that down on I think it was 8th Street, and shooting the exterior of our drug house, and had our police cars there, and our undercover narcs and all doing shooting and filming our drug bust, there was an actual one took place, actual bust with actual police taking place a half a block away down 8th Street. So it was around us, but we didn't get mixed up in theirs, and they didn't get mixed up in ours.
My guest is Robert Wise, who directed the new film Rooftops, which opens nationally on March 17th. I think the first scene in Rooftops is something of an homage to West Side Story, which you also directed. There's a chase scene that reminded me a little bit of the opening scene in West Side Story.
There is that. By the way, I want to make just a little insert here. I want everybody to realize, of course, that I had a very, very talented co-director on West Side Story named Jerome Robbins. Mm-hmm. And so I always like to mention that when it refers to West Side Story. Yes, it's a little similar, I suppose, in a way. The tempo, the up-tempo, the music, the chase, the running through the city and going from one place to another, very much like our opening prologue in West Side Story. What we don't have is a helicopter opening, of course.
Right. Let me ask you a few things about West Side Story. It seems that the biggest problem would have been in adapting the stage version to the screen, is making the artificial seem natural, in the sense that on stage everything is artificial, whereas when you're shooting on real locations, like the streets of New York, it could look really stagey and artificial gang members breaking into song and dance. So what kind of thinking did you do on that before actually working it out?
Well, that was the biggest problem we faced from the beginning, and this is something that Jerry Robbins and I struggled with the most in putting on the film. You see, the stage, as you point out, the stage is not real. You're once removed from reality. You have the proscenium arch there. You're not into reality, so people can go out of dialogue into dance or out of dialogue into song without a little sense of embarrassment. Film is a very, very real medium, and it doesn't take kindly to stylization, unless it's another fantasy like, let's say, Wizard of Oz. So we struggled with that the most. I was the one who insisted that we open West Side Story on the actual streets of New York. There was no way we were going to be able to get a stylized set such as they had on the stage to work in films. And Jerry was all for it. Bob, I agree with you completely, but you've given me the biggest challenge in the whole picture to put my most stylized dancing, which is in that opening, against the most real backgrounds that we'll have. So we struggled with it. One of the reasons I came up with that helicopter opening was to give people a look at New York, a real New York, but a look they hadn't seen before, a kind of an abstract look at New York, although it was real, to help put them in the mood to accept these kids down the line a little bit dancing in the street.
And the helicopter opening you're talking about is a long aerial shot of Manhattan, and then it kind of zooms down into where the gang members are.
Right. And then Jerry did something else there, too, that he when he got the kids out on the street after they went through the playground, if people recall that, they had the jets walking along, and they didn't just go into a dance. One of the kids kind of swings his arm in sort of a dance movement, and they walk along a couple more steps, and two of the guys do it. And then we got a few more steps, and then three of them do it. And before you know it, he had segued very slowly into dance on the street, and that helped very much ease us into it without that sense of embarrassment.
I'll preface this question by telling you that I love the movie and I love the choreography, but I was wondering if you ever thought, and Jerome Robbins ever thought, that people would almost make fun of the film because these tough macho gang members are breaking into really balletic choreography. I mean, it's modern dance, it's not ballet, but there's some very balletic moves in it.
Right. No, we didn't think so. It had worked wonderfully well on the stage. Nobody took any question of that, didn't take it apart. And, of course, Jerry's choreography in the show is also strong and so masculine, you know, we thought it would work. What we had to do was what I was describing to you a while ago, was to find ways to make it compatible with the realism of the screen. And I have to feel that the way the film has been received over the years, we were pretty successful in doing that.
The two of the leads in the Puerto Rican gang, George Takaris and Natalie Wood, weren't really Puerto Rican. Was it hard to find real Puerto Rican actors at the time to cast in the film?
Yes, there weren't any really that were right for those parts. We did a very exhaustive search for actors, both coasts, both in New York and Los Angeles, and we interviewed and read just literally dozens of people for every role. And it finally ended up with the ones we put on the screen. I think they came off just fine. And of course, we did have Rita Moreno, who is Puerto Rican, playing Anita, and that worked out fine. But we were going for the best people, and since we couldn't find everybody who was supposed to be Puerto Rican, who qualified as Puerto Ricans, we had to go the other way.
What did you do to make them convincing?
Well, worked with him, and of course George had played. Although George had played other roles on the stage, he worked on his accent, got the accent, and then in his looks, we used the darker makeup and all, and Natalie a little bit of that, and working on the accent, and sort of studying and knowing. Like, we had a lot of friends around. We did have a lot of other kids on the show in the other parts, smaller parts, who were Puerto Rican, and they spent a lot of time together, and I think they were able to pick up the kind of idiosyncratic aspects of the Puerto Rican people. You know?
Film director Robert Wise is my guest, and his new movie is called Rooftops, and it opens nationally on March 17th. Can we go back to your very early career, right after you got out of that shipping room at RKO,
right,
and you started editing?
Mm-hmm, sure.
You edited Orson Welles' film Citizen Kane.
That's right.
How much freedom did you have when you were editing that movie?
I had the same kind of freedom I had with any other director that I was working with in those days. People have questioned me about that, and I thought probably Orson, being the kind of hands-on man that he was, had come to the editing room and told me where to cut. He didn't do that at all. I worked with him, as I said, like with other directors. I would get a sequence, get all the film in a sequence. I'd put it into a first cut the way I liked it, first cut the sequence, my version. I'd show it to Orson then, and he might like parts of it. He might ask for a change here or there, to use a two-shot rather than a close-up, or put this line in some other angle. Well, the usual process you go through between editor and director. I would make those changes, show it to him again, and that was the way it went all the way through the film. I don't think that he ever came into the editing room one time to impose himself on the actual process of editing. But, of course, he had his input in it after I had made my cuts.
That was a film that broke a lot of conventions. What do you think of as the most unconventional thing that you did in the movie?
Well, I think it was, number one, it was an unconventional film to start with. You know, you looked at those dailies every day and were kind of dumbfounded at the kind of scenes you were seeing and the compositions you were seeing, the setups, the photography. I think the area that I had the most input in was the breakfast table scene, if people recall that scene that shows a series of very short little interplay pieces, the deterioration of the marriage between Kane and his wife. And The action, as it now appears in the film, the timing, the rhythm of that whole piece, the speed of the whip pans that we use going from one segment to another, and where the dialogue came in preceding each piece, the whole rhythm of the piece was all developed in the cutting room. It was a brilliant idea, brilliantly shot, but the rhythm and the sense of it as it is on the screen was all developed in the editing room, and I would think that would be the major contribution.
Now, you also edited Orson Welles' film The Magnificent Ambersons. That was a film that the studio took him off of because the film was going so over budget and it was very long, and he was...
Well, that's not quite the story, no.
Okay, go ahead.
No, he wasn't taken off. He was unable to finish. He had finished his shooting on the film, and war had just started when we were still filming it. And Orson was asked shortly after Pearl Harbor Day by our government to go to South America as soon as he finished filming on Ambersons and to make a picture with the Brazilian people, to make a film down there. It was part of a good neighbor policy we had in trying to keep all the countries in South America on our side of the war. So Orson did this. He grabbed at it because he was draft age. He was only about 27 then, didn't want to go in the army, so he left. So he did finish filming the picture before he went down to South America. And then later, after we had it all finished up and had bad problems at previews in which people just didn't sit still for it and laughed at it and all, Orson was unable to come back to the States and to be part of what we did to try to help the film and fix it. He was stuck down in Brazil making this film, and just no way he could get back. So he wasn't, as I say, taken off by the company. He was just unable to get back. And then I had to, along with Jack Moss, who was Orson's man on the film back here in L.A., to go ahead and finish it the best way we could to get a picture that the studio felt they could release.
Was there pressure on you from the studio to make cuts that you thought Orson Welles wouldn't have liked?
Not particularly. I don't think there was that kind of tug of war. I'd say Jack Moss was there all the time. Orson had been sent a copy of the film and sent back his thoughts on it. And someplace along the line, when I've lost, I had about a 36-page cable from him about suggested ideas and changes, this, that, and the other. And that was even before we'd had our previews. But we all were working for the same end, not to save as much of what Orson had done and the quality of what he had done, and still get a film for which the audience would sit still, because literally they were just disastrous previews the first two or three we had.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to cut, and we had to add some scenes, bridge scenes and whatnot. And I think the fact that the film has come down through the years as something of a classic in its own right means that we didn't completely vitiate everything that Orson had set out to do with the film.
The first film that you directed was Curse of the Cat People. This was in 1944, and it was produced by Val Lewton, who also did I Walk with a Zombie and Cat People, The Leopard Man. So after you were brought on to finish up that film, you directed The Body Snatcher, which starred Boris Karloff. This was a 1945 movie. And it's a film in which Karloff supplies a teaching doctor with freshly killed bodies for the doctor's anatomy lessons. It's a wonderful film. It's really moody and shadowy. And I was wondering, this might be unanswerable, but how you learned to get that kind of dark, shadowy, scary feeling in a film.
Well, it's part of it. Always starts with a story, and everything starts with that script and that story, and that was the nature of that piece, as well as parts of Curse of the Cat People. And Val Lewton, who was a terribly creative and talented producer, had a real knack for coming up with stories that lent themselves to doing that kind of dark, heavy, mysterious, effective kind of filming and look. These were black and white films, by the way, and that also lends itself, I think, more than even color to that sort of film noir kind of look. And we had excellent cameramen at RKO those days who specialized in kind of low-key effects and low-key lighting. And so we planned and staged and photographed that way. Lewton was very interesting. You see, he was such a contrast in his thinking to today's horror stories, which are so filled with the blood and gore and monsters and things. Lewton didn't deal in that with his films. He always felt that the greatest fear the audience has is the fear of the unknown, such as, did you hear that? Hey, what's that shadow over there? That kind of thing. That could be as scary to audiences and more than the specifics. And so that's why most of the films that Val was involved in had that kind of look and feeling that you could never really be sure what was out there behind that corner in the dark beyond what you could see.
Well, you mentioned shadows. I think the first time you see Boris Karloff, what you're really seeing is a shadow.
That's right. You just see a shadow. It's kind of scary.
Now, Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi were in this film. How did they feel about being in horror films for so long? Do you know?
I didn't talk to them too much about that. Boris was very keen about doing The Body Snatcher because if anybody in the audience knows the film, it's really a kind of an acting tour de force for him in his two or three marvelous scenes with Henry Daniell, who plays the doctor. It's a real kind of contest between the two. And Boris was very anxious to do it because he wanted to prove to the people and to the business that he was an actor, not just a person to put in horror films, you know, a monster, that he was not just a monster. So that was what his concentration was on. And Lugosi came in as kind of an afterthought. He wasn't in the original script. The studio decided it would be a very good idea if they could put Lugosi and Karloff on the marquee. So Mr. Lewton, who was a very talented writer as well, added in the part of the porter that Lugosi played. And Lugosi didn't work very long, just a few days, and he was not very well. He was not well at all. I had to kind of nurse him through the part as it was, so I didn't really get into any conversations with him about how they felt, except that I knew that Boris was very anxious to shed that image and show that he could do something beyond just be a monster.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. Film director Robert Wise is my guest, and his new movie is called Rooftops. It opens nationally on March 17th. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is film director Robert Wise. During his decades in the film industry, he's directed close to 40 movies, which have won 19 Academy Awards. His films include The Body Snatcher, The Day the Earth Stood Still, West Side Story, The Sound of Music, and Star Trek The Motion Picture. Early in his career, he edited Citizen Kane. His new film, Rooftops, is about homeless teenagers living on New York's Lower East Side on the rooftops of abandoned tenement buildings. The film opens on March 17th. You've done so many different kinds of pictures over your career. How did you get to choose the movies? Were you chosen, or did you choose most of the time?
Well, most of the scripts that I've done with stories have been the material that has come to me. People come to me and say, I have a script, or I have this property, I have this book. I've come up with a couple of them. I found The Haunting, one of my favorite films, a ghost story told in the 60s. I came up with The Sand Pebbles. I've worked on a few that haven't gotten on the screen, but most of them are either studio or independent producers, or a writer might send me a script and say, hey, this is something I'm trying to get off the ground, and what do you think? Would you like to do it? That's the way Rough Cut came to be. I had done a film for years. I happened to be in New York and got a call from the people, New Visions Company, New Visions Entertainment. It's a new film company that Taylor Hackford is back of, Taylor Hackford being a very well-known director. And asked me if I'd be interested in it. I read the script, liked it, and that's the way it happened.
Mm-hmm. Is there a kind of movie you feel most at home directing?
I don't have a favorite. I really people have asked me that many times, do I prefer to do musicals, adventure, drama, love stories. Whatever is the best script. I do have a couple of no-nos. I haven't done any Westerns since the 50s. I found I didn't really enjoy doing Westerns too much, and I thought the scene had been overdone for so many years. I gave that up, and I had one venture into spectacle back in the early 50s doing Helen of Troy, and made that all in Rome, and I found I didn't enjoy that genre of film, so I've avoided that since. But other than that, it happens to just boils down to what is a very good script, what catches me up, and what do I feel is material that will make a very good movie, and something that has another thing, that it's a film, a story that has something to say, some comment to make.
Rescreening some of your early films got me to thinking about how much the use of music in movies has changed over the years. Not only the kind of music that's used, but how it's used to underscore dramatic moments.
Yes, it has changed quite a lot. Of course, jumping right to Rooftops, my latest film, it is full of today's young music, rock music. It's just got a marvelous score by Dave Stewart, the English composer from the Eurythmics. And it's actually a field that I'm not really conversant with. And I was firstly very frank to admit it to Taylor Hackford and to Howard Koch Jr., the producer, saying, listen, you fellas will have to help me and be very strongly involved in the musical aspect of this film, because this is not my type of film. You know, I'm from Max Steiner or Bernie Herrmann or Jerry Goldsmith in terms of underscoring. And they did do that. But I think music is advancing, is changing, is used more in underscoring, putting aside the songs and that kind of treatment. I've always felt, at one time there was a kind of thinking in Hollywood, well, what do you need music in that scene for, to a given scene? I have always felt, what can music bring to a scene or a sequence? If it can bring something to it and add to it and add an element, a dimension, let's have it. So I know in my films, I'm very much for as much music as will contribute to the scenes that I'm putting up there.
Did you ever feel that you had a scene ruined by bad music or by the wrong music?
No, I don't think so. I think I've had some times when cues have been made, music cues have been made for a scene that I didn't like, and I just dropped it out. I didn't use it. I wouldn't let something go through that I felt was detrimental to a to a scene or a sequence. And occasionally you'll get a piece of music by a composer and it's already scored, and you get it in, and you just don't feel it helps the sequence, and you drop it out. But you don't leave it in if it's going to hurt.
Do you remember what the transition was like for you, going from black and white to color?
Yes, I my first color picture was kind of an adventure thing called, I think that's the first one, Destination Gobi, all shot up in the Pyramid Lakes in the desert north of Reno. And in those days, of course, we had big, tremendous three-strip cameras, you know. This was before single-strip color came in. They were big, huge, monster things to have to get around on locations, and that was an annoyance. I was fascinated by that prospect of doing something in color and seeing the difference and seeing how it had to be treated. And you found you had to get different sort of sets of values, not only for the cameraman's lighting, but for the colors of your costumes and your sets and all of that, to get those all working right together, much more so than you did in black and white.
Was the color true? Were you pleased with the kind of color you could get?
Yes, I'm pretty much pleased with it. Of course, the old three-strip was the truest color, I guess, that we've ever had. It's a little truer than the one-strip, a single-strip film. I've always felt, myself, that there's a tendency in films to have the colors be too colorful, too much color in them. And if I have a choice, I like to try to desaturate my colors a little bit in the films, because I think even though they're supposed to be an accurate reflection of what's out there, I think sometimes the whole process, well, to see the whole process of photography picks things up anyway, even in black and white. The blacks are blacker, the highlights are brighter than they are to the naked eye. So I think to counterbalance that in color, you have to, if you want real, true, authentic looking color in your scenes, you have to desaturize it in the printing some in the lab, not let it go all out.
You've seen so many different changes in Hollywood. Perhaps the most dramatic one is the change from the studio system to a dismantled
yes.
system. Do you ever find yourself wishing for the days of the studios, or are you glad that that's over?
Well, I'm not glad it's over, although I don't mourn it. There was several advantages in the old days. You know, all the studios had actors and writers, directors, and cinematographers, composers under contract, and there was this great sense of continuity in those days. You would almost go right from one picture to the other, go almost as fast as you wanted from one to the other. And that was fine. That was marvelous. Today, you know, it often takes a terribly long time to get something together, or to get the project together, to get the script everybody agrees on, to get the money people to come up with, to get the cast, and sometimes you'll spend a year or 2 years getting a package together. On the other hand, once you get that, I think you have a lot more freedom to control your own destiny in terms of the film and making the film, and also into the sales and promotion and the exhibition of it. I think we have much more follow through on that now than we used to have when we worked for the major studios. The one thing I find very interesting is that the one thing that hasn't changed in the filmmaking, and this was brought back to me having made my first film in 10 years with Rooftops, was the day-to-day shooting on the set, the filming, the actual making of the film with your actors and with your staff and with your crew is very much the same as it was when I started the business back in the 30s. It's a great group of people for the most part. They know their business. They work hard. They just knock themselves out. They work long hours, and they do it with humor and fun and love. And that has changed as little as anything in the business over the 50-some years I've been in it.
Since you started as a film editor and then became a director and producer, I'm curious if editing movies affected your approach as a director.
I suppose to a certain extent. You don't do it consciously, but obviously knowing film and knowing what you can do with the film in the cutting room does affect you. Many people have the idea that if you've been a film editor and turned director, that you would shoot much less film because you would know just exactly how you want it to go together. But that's not the case, really, certainly not with me. As a former editor, you know how valuable it is to have good coverage, a lot of coverage down in that cutting room. So later on, after the picture's finished shooting, we could do a lot more if you have a lot of angles. If you take a picture out to a preview and have a bad laugh someplace in the scene, you need to cut a line out. If you have that extra angle up there on the shelf you'd never use, you break it down and cut it in, it allows you to lose the line. There's just so much flexibility in the cutting room that former editors, I think, tend to shoot more film. But also, it's very, this last film. Now, Rooftops is not a giant film. It's a modest film in terms of size, although I think we have a lot of New York in it and all. But I found, because of the complexity of this piece, of getting the pieces of the sets and the streets and the rooftops and the interiors together, I had to draw on my editing experience, my editing knowledge, more on this little film, really, than any I'd ever made, just to piece it together properly.
You've made so many movies. Do you have any favorites among them?
Not a single one. I don't know whether most directors do or not. I do know Gaz Kazan has. I've read something where he said yes very quickly, America, America, but that was his own story, you know, so it was kind of autobiographical in a sense. I don't have. I've done, this was my 39th film, Rooftops. I have maybe 10 or 12 out of those that I would prefer or like better for one reason or another. You've named a number of them, your West Side Story, and Sound of Music, Day the Earth Stood Still, The Setup, Somebody Up There Likes Me, The Haunting, The Sand Pebbles with Steve McQueen, I Want to Live, if I didn't mention that, Andromeda Strain, about a dozen.
Okay, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you very much.
Robert Wise's new film, Rooftops, will be released on March 17th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with writer Ursula Le Guin. Her award-winning science fiction has explored such topics as androgyny and anarchy. She also writes short stories and poetry. Her new book is a collection of essays titled Dancing at the Edge of the World. I hope you can join us.
On the rooftop of New York City, you want some action in your life. This could be the perfect time. People gonna see your big escape. I say it's the perfect crime. Yeah, yeah. Everybody say yeah.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When film director Meera Nair wanted to make a movie about Bombay's child beggars, she typecast by hiring street children and giving them a crash course in acting. Coming up, Nair talks about her film Salaam Bombay, which has an Academy Award nomination for Best Foreign Film. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from bassist Buell Neidlinger and his band. Kevin says their sound is something like the collision between a jazz rhythm combo, a bluegrass band, and a drunk saxophonist. And book critic John Leonard reviews Carl Bernstein's memoir about growing up the son of leftist parents in the middle of the McCarthy era. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. Pilots at Eastern Airlines can continue to walk the picket lines in support of striking machinists. A federal judge in Miami today refused to intervene, saying under federal law, only the president could do that. But speaking at the White House today, President Bush once again said he would not declare an emergency, something that would set off a 60-day cooling-off period. Eastern's machinist union wants him to do that and threatens to stage secondary boycotts that could shut down railroads around the country unless he does. A judge in New York today extended a temporary restraining order against a secondary strike until Friday. But the union goes to court tomorrow to try to overturn the order. If it wins and starts secondary boycotts, President Bush again today threatened federal action.
I hope my position on secondary boycotts is well known. Thankfully, these boycotts have not yet materialized, and I hope they don't. Temporary restraining orders have been in effect yesterday and today in the New York and Philadelphia areas. But even when those restraining orders lapse, I remind all parties that secondary boycotts are not in the public interest, and I will send legislation to Congress to forbid them if that is necessary.
But on Capitol Hill, Democratic lawmakers are busy pushing through a bill to force an emergency declaration. At a hearing in the House today, Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner asked members not to pass such a bill. The White House got some good news today on the nomination of Defense Secretary-designate John Tower. Christopher Dodd today became the second Democrat to announce his support for the former Texas senator. The announcement may give new confidence to Republicans who already threatened to carry the debate on Tower into next week. More from NPR's Cokie Roberts.
Tempers flared repeatedly on the Senate floor today as debate on the Tower nomination continued. Republican leader Robert Dole accused the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Democrat Sam Nunn, of conducting a partisan inquiry into new allegations against the former Texas senator. In his capacity as chairman of the Subcommittee on Investigations, Nunn had dispatched staff members to check out new information on Tower. The Georgia Democrat claimed he was under the impression that the FBI was no longer looking into the Tower matter. Later this evening, Nunn told his colleagues that he now understands the FBI will consider new information and that the investigation subcommittee will turn over the case to the FBI. With that matter settled, the Senate continues to battle over whether to allow Tower to address the body, whether to release the FBI report, and when to vote on the nomination. Republicans claim they're now turning public opinion in favor of Tower, and they want more time to do it. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir today ruled out recommendations by his defense minister on ways to select Palestinians to participate in a Middle East peace conference. A spokesman for Shamir said the prime minister proposed that Jordan and Egypt help choose Palestinians from the occupied territories. Shamir's plan effectively rejects a proposal to elect a Palestinian delegation from the Israeli-held territories. Secretary of State James Baker and Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze discussed a number of issues today in Vienna, including human rights, arms control, and Central America. Baker called their two-hour meeting a good beginning. They met during the launch of new disarmament talks between NATO and Warsaw Pact states, and their wide-ranging discussions pointed up some important policy differences. The two men agreed to meet again in Moscow in May to discuss prospects for a first summit between President Bush and Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. The woman who's confessed to bombing a South Korean jetliner in midair 2 years ago today told a court in Seoul that orders to plant the bomb came directly from the son of North Korea's leader, Kim Il-sung. And stock prices were lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 4 points to close at 2290.71. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Bassist Buell Neidlinger is one of the most versatile contemporary musicians. As a jazz, classical, and studio musician, he's worked with stride pianist Willie the Lion Smith, avant-garde jazz pioneer Cecil Taylor, the Boston Symphony Orchestra, the Budapest String Quartet, Frank Zappa, Roy Orbison, Barbara Streisand, and Leo Kottke. And that's just a sampling. Neidlinger has a new album out, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it reflects the same sort of wild eclecticism.
Bassist Buell Neidlinger, tenor saxophonist Marty Crystal, and drummer Billy Osborne work together in the jazz group Thelonious, which plays the compositions of Thelonious Monk. Violinist Brenton Banks is a veteran of the Nashville studio scene. Mandolinist John Koenig works in Hollywood studios. Together, the five make up Buell Neidlinger's String Jazz, whose album Locomotive is on the Soul Note label. It's a set of 7 Monk tunes and 4 compositions from Duke Ellington's book. These days, lots of musicians play Monk and Ellington, but this group's approach is a little different. Picture the collision of a bluegrass combo, a jazz rhythm section, and a drunken dance band sax player, and you'll start to get the idea. Here's their version of Ellington's 1930 classic Rockin' in Rhythm, which Duke wrote with baritone saxophonist Harry Carney. One of the many nice things about Buell Neidlinger's new album is that the band plays obscure Monk and Ellington tunes, along with a couple of better-known numbers. That tendency toward avoiding the obvious runs through the whole project. Like Duke Ellington, Neidlinger coaxes unique orchestral textures from his group. Throwing a swaggery saxophone into the middle of a string band was a stroke of genius. Listen to this excerpt from Monk's tune, Break's Sake. Neidlinger says that he thinks of Monk and Ellington as being the same person, compositionally speaking, and this group blends the two composers' strategies.
Neidlinger inserts Ellingtonian instrumental effects into Monk's tunes, while mandolin man John Koenig solos with Monkish economy on Jumpin' Punkins by Duke's son Mercer Ellington. Neidlinger's string jazz breaks down walls between Monk and Ellington, between jazz and bluegrass, and between serious art and raucous fun, which are three reasons why Locomotive is one of the most satisfying albums I've heard in months.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Buell Neidlinger's string jazz on the Soul Note label. This is Fresh Air. Indian filmmaker Meera Nair's first feature film, Salaam Bombay, is up for an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. It tells the story of a 10-year-old boy who joins the hundreds of abandoned children living on the streets of Bombay. The film won the Cannes Film Festival's Camera d'Or, or Golden Prize, for Best First Feature by a New Director, as well as the Prix du Public, awarded by the Cannes public to the most popular film in the festival. Nair's previous films have all been documentaries, exploring such subjects as Indian strippers, Indian women forced to abort their female fetuses, and Indian immigrants living in Manhattan. Nair drew on her documentary experience to make Salaam Bombay. She shot on location and cast 17 of Bombay's street children in the film, kids who'd never acted before, but who Nair says had something that professional child actors don't.
The idea came to me as early as 1983, really, just as an image of a bunch of kids who surrounded my taxi at a red light in a very crowded junction. And there was a kid who was maimed, who had only a torso, who sat on a wooden platform and moved himself by on a wooden platform on wheels with his hands. And he was somebody who sort of hooked on to the scooter in front of me as the light changed to green. And then I was terrified of what would happen to him, and he just sort of let himself go by the momentum of the speed and just sort of pirouetted in the middle of the junction, sort of raising his hands to stop this imaginary applause. And I was just very struck by the flamboyance and the resilience and also the dignity of the children on the streets that I saw, that they would do absolutely everything or anything to get a buck, but and only very rarely beg. And the dream was then to have a workshop, much like I used to have as an actress 10 years ago in India, for street children.
The children who you worked with for this movie are used to living on the street and doing anything they can to make a buck. Did any of the kids, when you were doing the workshop or shooting the film, pull any scams? Did you have to dismiss any troublemakers?
One of our deals in the workshop was we were very careful, you know, to not be taken for a ride and not to be considered sort of guilty liberals. We had a job to do, and it was serious work, and when they accepted this work, these were the conditions. on a good day for a street kid, he makes about 10 rupees, which, I mean, it sounds absurd when you compare it to the dollar, but 10 rupees buys you, you know, 2 to 3 meals a day and maybe leftover money for a movie or something. So we paid the kids 25 rupees a day for the workshop, which is like 2.5 times what they would make, and give them food and everything. But the way we did this was we paid them 10 rupees in hand and 15 rupees in a bank and showed them how the bank worked, because a large part of this workshop was not just to train kids for acting, but also to, you know, expose them to different things about life, saving money or a bank or a postage, how a post office works, things like that, you know. So the deal was, once they accepted the workshop, they could see how their money grew every day, and at the end of 6 weeks, they would get the whole money. And so they had to be with us because of the time we were investing in them for the entire 6-week period.
Can you tell us something about the background of the boy who you chose as the lead actor in your movie?
Shafiq Sayed is from Bangalore, which is a town in South India. He doesn't get along with his family. His father works in a bicycle shop and is an alcoholic. His father wanted him to work in this bicycle shop with him, and Shafiq didn't want to. He tells the story that his father chained him to the shop with a hot bicycle chain, and when that happened, he just broke the chain and ran and met a friend who was going to Bombay, and he said to him the magic words, "Come to Bombay, come." And Shafiq just jumped on the train and came to Bombay. And when we met him, which was about a year after he'd arrived in Bombay, he was a rag picker on Grant Road Bridge, which is actually one of our major locations in the film. And he's very much a loner, very much a street kid. He doesn't, you know, like many street kids, is addicted to independence and just doesn't want discipline of any sort. But he's a remarkable child. He has great powers of concentration. He's very, very clever, very quick to grasp things. You know, within a week, he understood the notion of continuity and camera angles and, you know, his costume and where he was in the scene before, and all that he had completely grasped.
You shot on location, and many of your scenes were in the red light district. You had scenes in whorehouses. You had scenes in railway stations. You had one scene in the middle of a festival that was actually taking place
right
during the shoot. Were you chased away from any of these locations? Did you have to bribe anybody in order to be allowed to shoot?
Well, the way I entered the red light area, which is a very difficult place to enter to shoot, especially a full-fledged feature film, is I went in front of a union of 16 madams, sort of bejeweled and silked, you know, very, very imposing looking. And they were quite, I think, taken aback by the fact that I was a woman also. And also that I had a number of women working in the crew. And I told them the story quite honestly, which is not a story that depicts the red light area in any great light. And they just embraced me and said, "You're a woman like us and you're welcome." And so then I said, when I finally found the brothel I wanted, I had to negotiate with that particular madame who owned it, and we made a deal where I would work on the day, on the hours that she didn't work, which was during the daytime, and their work is at night. But the interior locations was often not a problem, because these were deals we made before we began to shoot. What was a problem was exterior locations. We shot a lot on the streets, and they were troublemakers. The community was generally, I would say, very helpful, but they were troublemakers. Anytime they see a film being shot, they think that's money, and that means extortion. And there was a gang of fundamentalists, you know, in Bombay who would really try to make trouble for us sometimes. So, you know, as a result, the atmosphere of our unit of people making this film was one that nobody could sit on their butt. I mean, they all had to pitch in and control crowds, whether you're an actor or whether you're a technician. You know, you do that.
Have you been able to keep in touch with the kids who you cast in your movie?
Yes, absolutely. We've put together, to our, you know, with great amount of effort, but to our satisfaction, a non-profit foundation called Salaam Balak Trust. Balak means child. And we've raised money through charity premieres of Salaam Bombay in India, about $42,000, and we are looking to raise about, you know, $70,000 more. And this will fund the operation, the permanent operation of 2 learning centers for 30 to 35 street kids each. But a number of the Salaam Bombay children will not, you know, are already doing what they want to do. And this place will operate for other street kids like them. our kids, of the 17 in the film, about 5 have gone to home to their villages, to their parents. About 4 are in school. And about the 3 older kids are doing little businesses of their own. So they're all in a very good place. The only kid who is constantly a challenge for us is Shafiq, the main child.
How do you mean that?
In the sense that he has always wanted to do certain things, like go to school, have a job, become a mechanic. These are the 3 things he's wanted to do over the last year. And every time it's been set up for him to do that, he's dropped out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we'll still do what he, you know. The idea is that he has to feel, you know, responsible for himself, which is the entire idea of our working with kids, that we are always there in some way, but you have to take on the responsibility yourself.
Your films really have focused on people who are marginalized, shut out from society. Yet it strikes me you're probably from a pretty prosperous background yourself, having gone to Harvard. You seem to really relate, though, to people who have been shut out.
Well, I come from a middle-class background. I went to Harvard on a full scholarship, thanks to the university. I must say, yes, I mean, I never thought about it before I began in film, but looking back, it's always about people living on the edge. And I must say that the kinds of people who do that and who survive it are inspirational to me. I'm inspired by their spirit of survival, by their resilience, and by their humor, and by the fact of how they lead their lives in a situation that I would certainly consider extremely difficult or impossible. And I like what really inspires me is the lack of self-pity about this. You know, the last thing they want is pity, and that is something that that teaches me about a way of living.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your movie.
Thank you.
Meera Nair produced and directed the film Salaam Bombay. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry.
What's happening?
Well, President Bush today at a news conference invoked the name of Lubbock, Texas, possibly to replace Peoria, Illinois. You know, and will it play in Peoria? He said, they love it in Lubbock, referring to the way his administration is being regarded there so far. We'll call Lubbock, Texas. Also, Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze meets with Secretary of State James Baker. They'll meet again in May to talk about a possible Gorbachev-Bush summit. And we have a report from Afghanistan from NPR's Deborah Amos. She has been with the Mujahideen inside Logar province, the area outside Kabul, controlled by the rebels.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Watergate story made Carl Bernstein one of the most famous reporters of our time. Nora Ephron's semi-autobiographical novel Heartburn made him one of the most infamous husbands of our time. Bernstein has just written a memoir about his parents called Loyalties. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
First, let's see if we can clear the air of stupidity and giggles. To the question, is there life after Dustin Hoffman and Jack Nicholson have played you in the movies? Carl Bernstein has answered with an angry, touching, soulful yes. Hoffman played the Washington Post Watergate Ghostbuster in All the President's Men. Nicholson played him in the movie version of his ex-wife Nora Ephron's Romana Clay, Heartburn. Bernstein's been better known, since writing The Final Days with Bob Woodward, as a man about the gossip columns than anything more socially redeeming. Loyalties will change all that. An account of his father and mother's romance with the American Communist Party, their son's attendant fury and confusion in the witch hunt years of his boyhood, the precise nature of left-wing union activity in the 1940s and 1950s, the waste of energy and innocence in a paranoid America, the meaning of the silence between the generations. Loyalties opens the mind and breaks the heart. Carl's father, Al, was a New Deal bureaucrat and an organizer of prison guards and hospital orderlies for the United Public Workers of America in Washington, D.C. and San Francisco. He represented hundreds of workers before loyalty review boards established under Truman's Executive Order 9835. These boards ask such questions as, How do you explain the fact that you have an album of Paul Robeson records in your home? And did you ever write a letter to the Red Cross about the segregation of blood? Bernstein's mother Sylvia organized women, led sit-ins to desegregate lunch counters and public swimming pools, and marched to protest the execution of the Rosenbergs. Several congressional committees went after Al, and the CIO purged his union. And like many radicals in the D.C. area in the 1950s, he went into the laundry business. He's now a fundraiser for the National Conference of Christians and Jews. The House Committee on Un-American Activities went after Sylvia. She now sells porcelain in a department store. The FBI showed up for Carl's bar mitzvah. Neither parent wanted their son to write this book, and they were wrong. It's not just that Loyalties demystifies radical activity so humdrum, Progressive Party politics, Pete Seeger picnics, a consumer movement to freeze the price of pork, that we wonder how it ever got demonized in the first place, nor that Loyalties reminds us of the cynicism and hypocrisy of witch hunters for whom being on the mailing list of a discount bookshop was proof of treason. We should have known all of this from Jessica Mitford, Al Richman, and George Charney, from Vivian Gornick's memoir of her father, or Clancy Siegel's wonderful novel Going Away. It's that Carl Bernstein, who grew up with Howdy Doody, Donald Duck, Mr. Peepers, and the Rosenbergs, has simultaneously demystified his own Oedipal irresolutions. This is a book about laundry, he says, or coming clean, but it's also about reconciliation, and not only of parent and child. Carl keeps crossing these bridges in Washington, from past to present. What used to be the South Capitol Street Bridge is now called Frederick Douglass. The Calvert Street Bridge is now Duke Ellington. If Al and Sylvia were guilty of anything, it was dedication to this kind of change before the rest of us, shamefully, were ready. Their son now finds himself proud of them. They ought to be proud right back. He crafts his way by art to love.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Loyalties by Carl Bernstein. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Carolyn Heilbrunn talks about women who lead unconventional lives. Heilbrunn is a feminist scholar, and she writes detective novels under the pen name of Amanda Cross. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews recordings of the late Hungarian pianist Dino Lupati performing Bach, Mozart, Scarlatti, and Schubert. And commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews two books on education, Wayne Booth's The Vocation of a Teacher and Robert Cole's The Call of Stories. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.